Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Russia's once richest oligarch is rotting away in a Siberian prison. Mikhail Khodorkovsky made billions playing fastball with Russian oil and gas in the post-Soviet 1990s, but lost it all when he crossed Vladimir Putin politically. Now he's fighting the Kremlin to get his freedom back and has hired a lawyer from the Bronx to help him do it. This hour on Point, an American attorney, a fallen billionaire in Siberia, and the future of riches, law, and power in a rising Russia. We'll be joined in a moment by American attorney Robert Amsterdam, who is representing the imprisoned Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And later in this hour, by Russia scholar Marshall Goldman in Moscow. But first, joining me today from New York is Christopher Stewart, contributing editor at Portfolio Magazine. He's author of a profile of Robert Amsterdam in the magazine's August issue. Christopher Stewart, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Tell us in a nutshell first the story of the billionaire. How did Khodorkovsky make his money? How did he end up in prison?
Khodorkovsky rose to riches in the very bare-knuckled 1990s in Russia. It was replete with gangsters and corruption and all sorts of chaos. Yeltsin was president at the time, and he was struggling to maintain power in 1996. He basically asked a number of these very increasingly wealthy capitalists, Khodorkovsky among some of the others who had benefited from the early 90s when communism fell and the Western world poured in. These ultra-capitalists basically helped bankroll Yeltsin's re-election, and for that, he gave them a lot of the country's resources, steel, oil, gold mines. It was called loans for shares, and they were basically rigged auctions where these national resources were handed over to a few politically connected men.
Help fund my reelection, said Yeltsin, and we'll chop up state resources and you'll end up owners. Khodorkovsky ended up at the head of Yukos, which he turned into a real oil and gas giant.
That's right. That's right. He westernized it. He eradicated a lot of the corruption and inefficiency. He brought in Western business leaders. He organized the books. He elevated their technology. By 2002, it was the biggest private oil concern in Russia and one of the most efficiently run organizations in the country as well. It was a model for Russian oil.
And by 2003, he was in a cage in a Russian trial, eventually convicted of fraud and tax evasion. We'll look at that, and others along with him, a lot of others went to jail. One, a very prominent, fled to Israel, now being Moscow now asking for a life sentence
for
murder, for a number of murders. Khodorkovsky himself, no angel, as you tell the story, even though he may have done something good with an oil company.
No, he is no angel. But as I said earlier on, it was a bare knuckled time. It was this sort of era of robber barons. They were all struggling for power, struggling for riches. Khodorkovsky was known to bully shareholders. He had these epic wars with corporate raiders. He funneled money into offshore accounts.
But he didn't
do anything that a lot of the other people weren't doing at the time. There really weren't any rules in the 1990s. It was this burgeoning economy with very few, very little regulation.
Was murder okay?
I don't know that Khodorkovsky was involved in any murder.
Though his head of security and one of his co-owners, partners, is charged with that by Moscow, though
right,
who knows.
Right.
A very tough
right.
time, and then he ran into the buzzsaw of Yeltsin's successor, Vladimir Putin. What happened there?
Well, Putin, as soon as he came into office, he made it very clear to these oligarchs that he wouldn't allow them to be as public and politically involved as they were in the past. He said he wanted to reform the economy, he wanted to reform the state, and if they wanted to continue, they wanted to keep their wealth, they had to lay low. And a number of different kinds of oligarchs emerged from that conversation. You know, there were the people that sort of towed the line. There were the ones that that basically allied themselves with Putin. And then there were ones like Khodorkovsky who decided to run up against him. He funded political parties. He started thinking about selling part of his company to Western oil companies, and he just talked about building
kind of oil giant in the Western style, right? I mean, his own pipeline, maybe to China rather than a government pipeline there, worth maybe $15 billion, the richest of the rich among Russia's oligarch. And the next thing we know, and people may remember this image of him behind bars in the Russian style, on trial, in a cage in the courtroom. And ultimately, here he is, a little tape of Khodorkovsky when he went to court in 2003 on charges of fraud and tax evasion. Then at the close of the trial here, he spoke in his own defense.
The entire country knows why I was locked up. It's so that I wouldn't interfere with the plunder of my company. Everybody knows I'm not guilty of the crimes I'm charged with. I do not intend to ask for leniency.
I did not intend to ask for leniency, said Khodorkovsky. Then, now, after some years in prison in Siberia, he does want out. What's he asking for, and how is Robert Amsterdam trying to help him, Christopher?
Well, a sort of a new picture is emerging in Russia, or a potentially different picture is emerging in Russia. Putin is now prime minister. His handpicked successor, Dmitry Medvedev, is now president. The feeling or the hope is that Medvedev will act differently than Putin, and will relook at the case of Khodorkovsky. He'll build in reforms. He's talked about this legal nihilism that pervades the Russian government.
What does he mean by that? When the new head of Russia,
he recognizes that there's a lot of corruption within the government, and that needs to be. That needs to be eradicated.
And legal nihilism meaning no hope among Russians and maybe foreigners working there as well, that if they get into the legal system, it'll work for them?
In the era of Putin, property was provisional. If you stepped over the political line and challenged him, he deployed law enforcement, and he bullied a lot of business owners out of their property. And this case is really interesting because it really brings up some pretty interesting issues: private property, the mixture of politics and business, and most prominently this notion of energy nationalism that Putin was sort of the real founder of and he propagated through his career.
Energy nationalism, meaning on the ground very often, the Kremlin actually moving into ownership. I mean, the same sort of, it might have been ugly, but a kind of liberation that went on in the 90s with assets reverting to powers in the Kremlin, including oil and gas in a big way.
Right. Instead of individuals taking over pieces of property owned by the state is retaking property or important energy resources that were owned by private individuals.
We're going to hear in a moment from Khodorkovsky's lead legal strategist, Robert Amsterdam, on why that may matter to Russia. But what's your sense, Christopher? Why this matters or might matter to the rest of the world? A multi-billionaire, he was an oligarch who, as you say, came up in a time when things got done fast and loose and sometimes dirty. I mean, why should the world care about what happens to Khodorkovsky?
Well, Russia's really at a – people perceive this case in the time of Medvedev as a sort of barometer for what's going to happen in Russia. Will property be provisional? Will it work to establish more a more prominent rule of law? Are human rights going to be respected? All of these things are pieces of the Khodorkovsky drama. And if Medvedev goes at it the way that that Putin does, well, then we're going to continue with a lifestyle and a business atmosphere that we saw under the age of Putin. If Medvedev emerges from this Putin shadow, we could see a much more progressive, democratic Russia. And Russia is a rising power right now. It's rich in oil, as you noted. Medvedev has been pressed to relook at the Khodorkovsky case by German Chancellor Angela Merkel. McCain recently, according to reports, had a conversation with Medvedev about the lack of democracy. But Medvedev has sort of stood his ground, at least at the moment. You know, he said that America has no place lecturing Russia. It's in a state of depression, he said.
And they're riding high. Khodorkovsky was plucked off a plane in Siberia by masked men at gunpoint, thrown in jail in Siberia. You talked to his mom. Does she expect to ever see him out of prison again?
She has great hope, obviously. But as far as I can tell, she believes that it's going to be a long time before her son ever gets out, if he does.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russia, riches, and the law. Russia's once richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, looking to get out of Siberian prison, and what his case tells us about power and law in oil-rich Russia. We've been talking with Christopher Stewart, contributing editor at Portfolio Magazine, where in the August issue he profiles Robert Amsterdam, lead legal strategist in the campaign to free Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He's an attorney specializing in cause lawyering and property rights in emerging markets, tough spots around the world. He's been at that for a long time. He joins us right now from Venice, Italy. Robert Amsterdam, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
What's the case you're making for your once mega-rich client, Mikhail Khodorkovsky?
Well, firstly, your intro to the show demonstrates the power that states have in respect to what John Pappalardo, a great Boston lawyer who works with us on this case, calls the presumption of regularity. The fact of the matter is, because they've tried this man, your listeners will think that he somehow is connected to heinous crimes. What we've been able to prove with actually a team of tremendous lawyers, some of the greatest lawyers in Russian history who have been working on this case, like Karina Moskalenko and Yuri Schmidt, what I think we've been able to prove very well is that these were not trials. These were not real charges. This was a show trial that actually makes the show trials of the 30s look good. Quite frankly, the situation in respect to the case was that, yes, politically, Khodorkovsky was guilty of fighting very hard for transparency, listing his shares, being one of the first companies from Russia to list their shares in foreign stock exchanges, getting his companies properly audited, and engaging in transparent business activity. And if you're Vladimir Putin or any of the other FSB types around him, there's nothing more dangerous than having the economy actually being run transparently.
FSB, as in former security and intelligence men, what do you think it was? Was it really his fight for corporate transparency that got him in prison, or his political work challenging Vladimir Putin?
Well, you know, you have people argue it's the pipelines. Whatever it was, it had nothing to do with those charges or that horrific trial. And the Council of Europe and many European governments have engaged the Russians on that, because what that trial did do was really set back some of the positive moves in Russia towards rule of law. And that's why today's New York Times has this massive story of an individual, Mr. Browder, who was a pro-Putin investor, one of the major investors in Russia.
This is an American who had a major stake in Gazprom, the oil company.
Who found himself being raided by hostile members of this government, and literally saved himself from a very dangerous fate. And we're watching what's happening now with BP, and we've watched this serial robbery and pillaging of Western companies.
BP,
and
this is British Petroleum in their joint venture in Russia, kind of being physically driven out of the country by their Russian billionaire counterparts at the moment. It appears from the headlines.
Exactly. And what we're saying about Khodorkovsky and what why he had the strength and the courage to fight this, as opposed to leaving, which is something he could have done, is he recognized this tremendous danger to Russia and the people that have been involved, some of these heroic lawyers, a man named Alexanian, who had been at one time the chief legal advisor to Yukos, who had been ill, arrested when he was ill, deprived of his drugs, left in exquisite pain in absolutely inhumane conditions, where he contracted tuberculosis and AIDS, and
you yourself facing kind of you yourself facing kind of bully boys in Moscow when you were representing Khodorkovsky there.
Yes, in fact, you know, quite frankly, I'm very grateful I was deported. Many of the people that I've had to work with and that I'm still working with in this case are Russian lawyers with Russian passports who, on each day, don't know what fate has in store for them. Some of the journalists I was with during the first trial, like Anna Politkovskaya, who was incredibly heroic, were murdered for their efforts. So I think it's very important that your listeners understand that Khodorkovsky has never been found guilty of anything by anybody other than through this sham process.
He's scheduled now to be released in 2011, but as you try to get him out, there are more charges being brought, new charges of money laundering, of stealing millions of barrels of oil that could add, we read here, 20 more years to his time. In legal terms, Russian legal terms, what are you attempting right now, Robert Amsterdam?
Well, the team, and as I said, there's an entire team working on this, is engaged in a series of activities from Strasbourg to the actual court in Chita, Siberia, where there will be a parole hearing. This very heroic group of Russian lawyers is trying to free this man, and also, I think, very importantly, demonstrating the completely morally bankrupt and entirely political nature of the process. And we have to keep doing that because what the Russian Federation, and not even the government, what that group of people who have pocketed much of my client's wealth, what they want is they want the West to forget that this case exists. And that is the intention of this piling on that Professor Goldman will mention, which reminds us of the Soviet era, this piling on of charges to this individual. They want, as they illegally put him in Siberia, they want to make sure the West forgets.
Marshall Goldman, author of the new book Petrostate, will join us in a few minutes from Moscow. We've got a lot of listeners, and we'll go to what you see as the biggest issues here as well. But let's go to callers first. From Oxford, Iowa, Judy's calling. Judy, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to speak up for the Russian people. These men that are referred to as capitalists were actually big-time thieves who plundered the assets of the Russian people. They make the guys at Enron seem like little kindergarten kids stealing pennies.
Would you put Mikhail Khodorkovsky in that category?
Absolutely. All of the oligarchs. There are more billionaires in Moscow now than there are in any other city, and it's because of the thievery that occurred when there was no regulation and everything was privatized. The oligarchs stole everything that wasn't tied down, and the rest of the country, the rest of the Russians, are poor. They are poorer now than they were under communism, and I'm not talking about the people in the city. I'm talking about the people in the villages.
So do you have sympathy for Khodorkovsky? Do you think that it's an issue of rule of law or something else at stake here, Judy?
What about justice? Does justice mean anything? The Russian people are extremely bitter about what happened to them during privatization and the way the big-time crooks stole everything.
Robert Amsterdam, what do you say to Judy, our caller from Iowa?
Well, to be frank with you, whenever anybody uses a term and describes a group of people, whether you call them oligarchs or some other term, as a lawyer, I always shy away from that. each individual needs to be judged in respect to their own activities.
A lot of Russian resources went to a few men in a short time. I mean,
well, let's just make something clear that those resources, for instance, the ones during my client's tenure, actually managed to increase by a vast and exponential amount, which that man, my client, happened to share with thousands upon thousands of Russian investors. Not only did he do that, not only did he raise the net equity of the company exponentially, but he set up the first pension plan, which gave normal workers in Siberia the right to finally cash in on those years of work. And let me assure Judy that when you talk about these people as oligarchs, you need to look at them individually. Because in Mikhail Khodorkovsky's case, the shareholders and the workers and all of those people and all of the philanthropic institutions he funded all benefited from his tenure at Yukos. Since that time, and he was working at a time that oil was at $18 or $20 a barrel, after these thieves and the government stole his assets, and oil has now rocketed to $140 a barrel, it is those people who have pocketed so much money and left their citizenry in penury, left their hospitals a shambles, it is those people who need to be put on some sort of analysis of justice.
Christopher Stewart, if I may turn to you for just a moment, stand by, please, Robert Amsterdam. But Christopher, you went to Russia for your reporting for this piece in Portfolio, and as I read you and others, an awful lot of Russians share Judy's perspective on the oligarchs and maybe Khodorkovsky in particular.
Yes, absolutely. I think the reason why that is I don't know if they definitely share it, mainly because there is a rising middle class. I think they're fed a certain state backed media. They are sort of they have vacations now. They have home. They have homes that they own. They have cars that they drive. They have a nicer lifestyle.
But if you took a vote in Russia or took a poll, do you think most people would be backing Mikhail Khodorkovsky's case or opposed?
Well, ultimately, I think the problem here is this really wasn't a case about what happened in the 1990s, and that's it was about things that happened in 2000 to 2003, tax evasion. So ultimately, it's not really a judgment on the 1990s. It's a judgment on taxes.
But Judy clearly is still thinking about the 90s and still asking about justice there. Judy, thanks for calling. Let's get one more here from Somerville, Massachusetts. And Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wondered what your guests would say about the other side of Khodorkovsky. As I understand it, he was one of the first philanthropists in Russia through his Open Russia Foundation. And so I don't want it to be painted as if he's one-dimensional.
Robert Amsterdam, I'm sure you'll speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you. Yes, I think the fact of the matter is Khodorkovsky was a trendsetter in terms of not only his private philanthropy, which was quite unique because it was not done in his name. He set up Open Russia, took that concept with the assistance of George Soros and ran with it in Russia.
And what were they working for or trying to?
They were establishing internet education throughout the country. They were funding all sorts of Russian-based NGOs, working towards educating youth on essentially democratic principles, if you will, sort of the opposite of what the Nashi, this youth organization under Putin, had become. He was very, very involved and became really the preeminent sponsor in Russia of that type of philanthropy because of his commitment, as I said, to sort of living through action and to establishing this transparent entity. And that's why when people want to figure out the oligarchs and figure out the attack, the major question people need to ask themselves is, why this man? Why the man that was moving towards transparency and philanthropy and had moved his stocks into Western companies and had wanted to sell out and actually merge Russia into the world market, why was this man attacked? That becomes the question. That's why you can't use the term oligarchs and attempt to portray this one individual as somehow obligated to take the burden of the 90s.
He was the rich.
For that's not justice.
He was the richest of the rich, but it's a fascinating story. 2006 report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development talked about the legal and political onslaught against Yukos, his company, as the most alarming sign, as you report, Christopher Stewart, of Russia's, quote, shift toward greater state control. Robert Amsterdam, you raise the question, why? Why this attack? What's your big answer to that? Why?
Well, the big answer is that more than just what his defenders say is the fact that this man presented an alternative vision to what was out there. He represented this vision of transparency and the fact that Russia could participate, not as they are right now as monopolists in respect to energy, but as real players, not a petrostate, but a real state, developing as part of a European home. He had a very powerful, very persuasive vision that he felt his entrepreneurial work could help develop. And he was really a shining example. And that's one of the major reasons I believe this man was attacked in the way that he was attacked.
Let's get a call from Arlington, Massachusetts. And Patty, hi, Patty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention the same side of Khodorkovsky and Yukos Oil, that my son, when he was 15, applied for and got to go to Russia fully paid for by Yukos Oil so that he and some other American students could work with some Russian students of the same age and build a model government together. So an amazing pro-democracy thing that happened, as far as I know. It was the only time that it did. But Khodorkovsky was a real advocate of trying to build democracy and get folks thinking along those lines.
Patty, we appreciate that angle, and thanks for calling. Christopher Stewart, we've just got you for a couple more minutes here. You're our reporter. Robert Amsterdam, you know, makes a strong case. He's a good attorney, and he's got a big client there on the and their interests on the other side. I mean, most of the ownership has now gone to people, we read, very close to the Kremlin. So we're talking big money here. How do you interpret this game, very serious game, that's playing out right now, Christopher? Do you see Khodorkovsky getting out of prison? And how do you interpret Robert Amsterdam? I mean, Amsterdam's path that he's on, he's already been up against some tough response from the Kremlin. You know, if he can't get his guy out, maybe he can. But if he can't, what do you see him playing for here?
Well, you know, the stakes, as you noted, are really, really high. The court system, as even Medvedev recognizes, is hobbled. And what Amsterdam has done is he's taken it out of the courtroom. He's created a sort of a courtroom in the public sphere. He has brought to light a lot of the things that happened during the trial. He's made people aware of the lack in human rights, the lack in democracy, and the lack of rule of law, and he's been an enormous advocate of that. And in fact, in the story, I sort of describe him as this, Soviet propagandist. But that's certainly not meant.
Meaning
in any
what?
Sort of, meaning that he's become this very passionate advocate for a transformed Russia, a Russia that's free, that's open, and that abides by the rule of law.
That's a tall order at the moment in a time of the rising very rich Russia riding on those huge oil prices. Christopher Stewart, thanks very much for being with us. Enjoyed the piece in Portfolio Magazine. Thank you for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Russia, riches, and the law this hour. Russia's once richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, looking to get out of Siberian prison. Cause lawyer, self-described Robert Amsterdam, joins us from Venice, Italy, and we'll hear more from him. We're joined as well right now from Moscow by Marshall Goldman, professor of economics emeritus at Wellesley College, author of the new book, Petrostate, Putin, Power, and the New Russia. Marshall Goldman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
What do you see at stake in the Khodorkovsky case, if we can look at it that way, Marshall?
Well, Khodorkovsky's no choir boy, but Putin I would not want as a Supreme Court judge. The trial, I think, as Robert Amsterdam indicated, was really a mockery of justice. The judge was getting instructions on the phone of what to do. Khodorkovsky certainly stands, in my mind, guilty as charged for many things. But again, as Robert Amsterdam suggested, there were others who were equally guilty. They happened to pick him. And one of the reasons I think they picked him that I don't think was mentioned so far was that Khodorkovsky was negotiating to sell 40 to 50% of Yukos, which was at that point Russia's largest oil company, to both either Chevron or ExxonMobil. And he was acting, when you have $15 billion net worth, as Khodorkovsky did at that point, according to Forbes magazine, you know, you get kind of cocky. And so he was making state policy. By that I mean he was talking about negotiating a big oil contract with China, which up until this point had been a matter of what the president or the prime minister did. He was also talking about building pipelines, and this was a monopoly of one of the state companies. So...
And pipelines right out of the country, right, to China, perhaps.
That's right. That's right. And within the country to export in Murmansk in the north. But the point is that all the oil pipelines were controlled by one state company. So I think they thought he was getting too uppity. And then he openly boasted at one point that he could control votes in the Duma. And there were these cases where there was illegality. Kenneth Dart, for example, had one of his companies basically stolen by Khodorkovsky. There were also, it did happen that there were some murders. Now, I don't say that Khodorkovsky was involved, but we know people were murdered. This was, as Robert Amsterdam says, this was not a Sunday school picnic.
So what do you think it matters now? What do you think I'm sorry, Marshall Goldman, but what do you think it matters now, the fate of Khodorkovsky? Is it in fact important to... What, helping at least take a reading on where Russian law, rule of law are headed, power and the Kremlin? Do you see it as a significant, indicator?
I think I do. I agree. It is important that this be looked at, and particularly now because there's the new president, Dmitry Medvedev, has talked about, as somebody else mentioned earlier on the program, legal nihilism. He wants to stop that. He comes to it as a lawyer. Who does, and it has at least indicated in some of the things that he said, that he wants to correct some of the abuses. He wants to stop. He set up a special commission on corruption, which is an implicit indictment of Putin. So, you know, they do want to belong to the family of nations. They do want to stay as a member of the G8. And there are some efforts to try to remove them, not only because of the Khodorkovsky case, but of the end of elections of the governors that took place. Putin is a pretty tough guy, and he undid some of the reforms that were so promising earlier.
Robert Amsterdam, what about it? There's the no choir boy line again, and under it all, the question of what it matters to Russia's future, what happens with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, how do you see it?
Well, I as I've said earlier, the question could be asked of any of us on this show as to how many of us are choir boys. The issue is, and I agree with Professor Goldman, this was not a trial. And its importance geopolitically is vast, because what is presently going on, as I think is very, very well put out in the professor's new book, what is going on in respect to Gazprom and what is going on in respect to Russia's activities in respect to energy globally, and we've just seen this meeting with Chavez yesterday.
Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, yeah.
This hubris, this impunity, this lack of adoption to international law standards that we've seen in Georgia. All of this, in a small way, relates to the license that Putin believes he got from the Russian people at the end of the Yukos trial, where he had this massive theft of assets. And as much as we challenge what happened at the Yukos trial, we now, I think, have a world consensus about that. We also need to underscore the fact that Yukos itself was illegally confiscated in a way that almost no one on earth deems even worthy of argument. It was a theft. They didn't turn to law. And they didn't get these assets to assist the Russian people. They pocketed vast billions of those monies, and they've used that control not to assist markets to develop, but to challenge markets and to control markets and to buy other assets. So it represents a very dramatic threat. So I have in the past called Khodorkovsky an energy hostage, because I really do see that the Yukos case began this tendency within the Kremlin that has led to this ongoing pattern of violations, not only of human rights, but business rights. And as I said, today we see the situation with the individuals from BP essentially being locked out and forced to leave Russia. This all stems from, in my view, the West not standing more firm about the central nature of the symmetry of opportunity and the need for all of us to return to the rule of law in this type of dealing.
Marshall Goldman, in Moscow, do you see this case in some dimension, in some way, as part of a picture that will determine, I don't know, what kind of world we live in, what role Russia plays in it, and with its oil rich, its oil weight, I guess, where it pushes not only its own internal policy and rule, but where it pushes the international environment on law?
Well, Russia's pushing pretty tough now, and their attitude is very cocky. I mean, I just finished another article entitled Russia is Back. They resented very badly when they lost their superpower status as a military power, as a nuclear power. They still have nuclear power, but right now it's really energy power they have, and the ones that really have to worry about this are the Europeans, particularly those who are getting natural gas. If you look at how dependent Western Europe is, it's really pretty scary. Germany, for example, now gets over 40% of its natural gas from Russia. It gets the same amount percentage-wise in terms of oil, but the oil, you can usually find substitutes. Natural gas, you're really limited to a pipeline. And so they have the power, as we saw in Ukraine, and we saw Belarus, and we've seen just recently in Georgia and with oil in the Czech Republic. They use that as a very powerful weapon, and there's not much you can do about it. And you know, it's a bit awkward for those of us in the West to tell the Russians, you've got to do this, because they say, look, you've got to be more democratic. They say, look, it's our oil, we'll do what we want, and they're doing what they want, and those in control are basically taking care of themselves. It's what is interesting for me, I mean, and here's the case that I would make if I were dealing with the oligarchs. The first echelon of oligarchs, people like Khodorkovsky, okay, again, I said I don't think they behaved properly, but what has happened under Putin, you've created a new echelon of oligarchs, many of whom now are there. When you had an earlier call from, I think it was Julian and I, where she said, Russia has now more oligarchs in Moscow than there any other city in the world. That's true. But the new ones who have just come on board recently are in part people who have done this under the Putin regime and who are what the Russians called Siloviki, kind of alumni of the KGB, alumni of law and order groups.
So a lot of power being wrapped up in one bundle there. Let's take a call from Wilton, Connecticut, and Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. I wonder why any of this comes as a surprise, given the Russian tendency to revert to authoritarianism throughout its history. It reminds me a little bit of Comrade Stalin, who replaced the original cronies of the Bolshevik Revolution with his own band of thugs. I also wonder whether those who are involved in defending Mr. Khodorkovsky might be concerned about their personal safety in light of what happened to Alexander Litvinenko in London.
Mm-hmm. Robert Amsterdam, how about it? Are you fighting history here? And what about it? Do you take tea with visitors from Moscow?
Well, firstly, you know, as someone who was privileged to know Politkovskaya and others in Russia, I don't believe Russians have an authoritarian gene. And I come to this dispute out of a love of Russia, and not to criticize the Russians. And in terms of, you know, whether I drink tea with the people from Moscow, the answer is as often as I can. I fight in Nigeria, Guatemala, been doing a case there for 10 years. You know, risk when you're dealing in these countries is part of what you deal with. And quite frankly, the intimidation factor is not an accident. It is designed to keep people quiet. And it takes people. I salute Professor Goldman's new book because the Russian state often uses things like visas and others to silence academics. And Of course, they deported me. So the idea is not to give in to that kind of intimidation.
We salute you speaking up, but when you say what sounds kind of easily that there's no authoritarian gene, maybe not genetic, but there sure is a lot of history here that our caller Tom points to. I mean, do you worry that those who push for something else are and may always be the minority in this country, Russia?
Quite frankly, no, because, when I look at the control over the media that exists today and contrast this with the period under Yeltsin and with the way NTV thrived and the way journalism thrives and, in fact, on the Internet continues to thrive, I'm not a Marxist in that sense. I'm not a determinist in that sense. And I don't see this as being the inevitable fate. In fact, if the 1993 Constitution had been drafted differently, this level of authoritarianism we're seeing now might not have been allowed to prosper. So I think it's just a shame that they've ended up where they are today in terms of authoritarianism, but I think it is possible, and I believe strongly that it is possible for this to change. And I happen to say, in terms of the new president, addressing legal nihilism and having the courage even to make that statement, and to make the statement he made in his opening address when he spoke of him being in charge of human rights. These are very important statements that are out there and that do change the context of domestic perceptions. So I would salute him for that.
Dmitry Medvedev, Putin's handpicked successor, a lawyer, a law professor himself. Let's go to Ernie in Belmont, Massachusetts. Ernie, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I was living in Russia in the mid-90s when a lot of this was going on. And, I mean, I understand that Khodorkovsky may be singled out for this, but the idea that he deserves any kind of legal clemency, to me, is laughable, because it wasn't until he made billions that, he even began the idea of attracting Western investors and offering any type of transparency in his business dealings. I mean, the guy is a thief, lock, stock, and barrel, and let's please not forget this. Yes, he was singled out, but, I mean, this is a problem in Russia. I mean, it is a legal cesspool, and, I mean, laws are applied arbitrarily. I mean, trying to do business in Russia as a foreigner was, incredibly difficult, because we never knew where the law would stand on a number of things. Like your guest mentioned earlier, there were no rules.
Ernie, we appreciate the perspective, and I can only imagine. Let me get one more here. Our time is short. Stephen in Watertown, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Stephen.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was a tour operator. I have been a tour operator in the Russian Far East, where they study Siberian tiger and other in the nature reserve called Zapovednik. Mm. And recently, within the last 5 years, I was trying to put together a program which had to do with the gulags, which under Stalin were the work camps. And when we were in Irkutsk, which is near Lake Baikal, we interviewed a reporter in the area, and we found that under Putin that he had closed all the history and records with respect to the gulag or labor camps. My problem is that Khodorkovsky is well known, and yes, your previous guest was correct that he's probably become more workable with respect to respect, but in recent years, and since he's made his millions and billions. But the fact is that under Putin, they've closed off just about everything and reverted back to the old Soviet style of government. And it's disturbing to me because it's affected all the NGOs or nonprofits. They have been just outlawed. This is no longer the rule of law. It's the rule of the Kremlin, and it's very unfortunate.
Stephen, our time grows very short here. Marshall Goldman, a last thought for you. As you watch what unfolds with Khodorkovsky, as we watch it, how do you see the stakes? How should we think about it?
Well, I think that this is a period of robber baronism of a sort that was unfortunate. Certainly people were guilty of all kinds of crimes then, but what disturbs me more than anything is that now you're replacing that group with another group which is equally, I think, guilty of behavior, including, for that matter, Dmitry Medvedev. What nobody has mentioned so far is that the new president of Russia actually was the chairman of the board of Gazprom, and even though he's trained as a lawyer, he has himself participated in some of these things. So if Russia is going to be really a good member of the G8, become an international partner, it's got to reform. But as long as they have all these assets, they say they're ours, we'll do what we want with them, and you have no right to tell us what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. So it's not going to be an easy road ahead. And with two new presidents, new president of Russia, new president of the United States, I'm not sure if they're going to be able to develop the relationship that President Bush and President Putin had. And so we may find some more tension even internationally, which would be unfortunate.
Marshall Goldman in Moscow. His new book is Petrostate. Thanks so much for being with us, Marshall.
Thank you.
And Robert Amsterdam, we've just got a minute here. Last thought goes to you, sir.
Well, I appreciate it. And I think what I would ask listeners to be aware of in respect to the Khodorkovsky case is that this fight is something that is reflective of a matter that is as central to them as what they pay at the tank, what they pay when they fill up their cars. The fact that Russia controls this level of energy and operates with a level of hubris and impunity in respect to energy is in no small way related to the theft of all of these assets.
Robert Amsterdam, lead legal strategist for Mikhail Khodorkovsky in prison in Siberia, once the richest man in Russia. Robert Amsterdam, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.